Hey, everybody. My name is Cushing Phillips. I'm an alcoholic. I used to be a gutter drunk. By the grace of God, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the example of people like you, I haven't had to live that way since April 7th, 1988, and for that I am profoundly grateful. I'm going to move some stuff around because, you know, it's my podium now. I want to thank Scott and the committee for the loving invitation. We've been working on this, you know, through some COVID and some debauchery or something. I don't know what all that was about. And so here I am, and, you know, blame them. John, thank you so much. It's funny when I go someplace and I'm given the privilege of sharing my experience, strength, and hope. I'm never sure how much camaraderie to enjoy beforehand, because I might tell my best stories beforehand and leave nothing for the podium. But I have absolutely loved this weekend so far, and I'm looking forward to the rest of it once we get through this. The space, the food, the friendship and the friendliness, and all placed in the middle of one of the most beautiful places I've ever been. So thank you so very much for sharing it with me. Why is there a lab sitting right here? Are you thinking I'm walking up and down the aisles? You know. I'm supposed to share with you in a general way what I used to be like and what happened to me and what I am like today. And I've already done that. I used to be a gutter drunk. And what happened to me is that the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the book, program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the God of my understanding and the example of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, have revolutionized my entire way of thinking and being. And what I'm like today is you know, probably intolerable, but that's okay. God grant me. I'm not supposed to be here. People in my family aren't alcoholic. My parents, and I've shared this before, my parents drank every single day, one drink. And my sister, who grew up right down the hall, she's married to the same man now for 30 years, and my parents were married to each other for 50 years before Pops died. And my younger sister, she's married and has a wonderful home and a family and a profession, and I went to jail a lot. I don't know what happened, except that when I was 7 or 8 years old, I was at a reception for Father Traub. He was retiring from the church we went to as a family. And up in the fellowship hall, they had adult punch, champagne punch or something. And down in the Sunday school rooms, they had some orange juice or something. And so, you know, I was 7. I was ready to go out on my own and embark on a career. So we started sneaking drinks, you know, that those earth people, the little half glasses they would leave sitting on a table. I know none of my fellowship members here left any half glasses anyplace. And we would race around the corner, and we would all share, and we would giggle in a very adult and grown-up way. And some funny things that night. I learned an important lesson. If there's a limited supply, don't share. Don't share. I learned how affordable or economical it is to pick up what you've left behind rather than go buy my own. That came in handy later, although a few people got a little mad at me. I didn't feel the effect of alcohol that night, but I walked around stumbling and slurring my words like Otis off Andy Griffith. Don't know why. I don't know where I got that image in my head that that's what was supposed to happen to me. And then later on, in looking back, what I discovered, and the most important thing, is that from the very first time I put alcohol in my body, I drank as much as I could, as fast as I could, until something or somebody stopped me. And that's how I always drank. That night, Mama caught on, grabbed me up by the ear, took me out of the fellowship hall, took me home. Later on, the cops got involved, or the bartender cut me off, or I passed out, or blacked out, or wrecked a car, or even just ran out of money. Something happened to stop me from getting that next drink. But never in my life have I pushed myself back from a bar and said, you know, I think I've had enough. I don't think I qualify for Alcoholics Anonymous because I drank too much. But I'm absolutely certain that I qualify for Alcoholics Anonymous because no matter how hard I tried, and I tried as hard as I couldn't seem to drink enough. I just need one more. Give it to me in a go cup. I'll leave. Let me write a check. And so I experienced this first time that I ever put booze in my body. And did it start an allergic reaction? I think so. Did it start the whole mental obsession? I don't know. I didn't start drinking on a regular basis at that point. And it's all in that kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade, all of a sudden my world is getting a little bit bigger than just my family and the kids on the street. And so I don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg, but the lies began. The fear began of what you think about me and how I can oppress you and what I can do to be somebody. I had this idea in my head somehow that I had to be a little bit better than everybody else or I just wasn't worth anything. And so I started to develop some wonderful tools for living in a self-centered world. I became a liar and a cheat and a thief. And I would walk through my life and I would flash cash and I would impress you with these stories of daring do. And I probably slew dragons. I don't know. I remember one time I told some kids I had a plastic shin implant. I'm not sure what that is. I'm not sure why you would tell somebody that. But at the time, it seemed like the thing to do. And if you understand it seemed like the thing to do, you and I are probably related. And so life is going on really good, and I'm cheating my way to straight A's, and I'm doing well in Scouts because I've got them all impressed, and I'm singing in the church choir, and I'm serving at the altar of our church, and I'm not causing too many problems for my mom and my dad. And some things happened in rapid succession. My little sister was born when I was 9 years old. There's a resentment for you. You heard about that. I mean, all of a sudden, I'm the middle child. And I already had one because my name is Cushing. I don't know who does that to a kid. I will tell you, on the day I was born, my father gave me the greatest gift a man can give, his son. My name is Cushing Phillips III. He gave me his name clean. No reputation, no tarnish. Actually, an outstanding reputation, no tarnish. I could never do the same, could I? But anyway, I digress. And so that happened, and we had moved and changed schools. And so now I'm in the fifth grade at a brand new school, which is a really rough time. And I don't know, everything's a rough time when you're me. And so things start to move along. And in sixth grade, we changed schools again. And then I go into junior high, and I changed schools again. And I had a lot of stress. You know, I was having to keep up, you know, at least 30 plates in the air at that point. And I found some friends. Budweiser, Jack Daniels, Jose Cuervo. And I began to spend a great deal of time with my friends. I mean, I found a lot of other friends along the way that came in baggies and bottles, but or little thingies, but those were my best friends. And so down at the reservoir, and we would be drinking Jack Daniels, or up at the pool house, and we would be doing shots of tequila, or we'd go down to the Lake Michigan and go smelting, and I don't care nothing about smelt, but boy, howdy, I love Mad Dog 2020, a bonfire, and some dope. And life was good. For most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It is release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good. So apparently I was a normal person. It began to turn on me sometime in late junior high and early high school, and I began to have to go see guidance counselors and family counselors and some psychologists and a preacher or two. I went down and I actually had a pressing dilemma in my personal life that I couldn't talk to anybody about. I couldn't talk to my friends. I talked to Jack Daniels and Jose Cuervo a little bit about it, but I couldn't talk to my parents, no way. I couldn't talk to anybody about it, but I could talk to my priest. And I went down and I talked to my priest. And my priest told me that he was very sorry to hear all of that, but I was anathema. And if you don't know, the word anathema means you are unloved by God. And so despite every message I had ever received, despite everything I'd ever been shown by everybody in my family and in the church community that we had grown up in, I believed one man. And so I turned my back. And as I turned my back and everything began to fall apart in my life, I was thrown out of high school and, or thrown out of the public school system by the time I was a senior. I just didn't go to class. I needed a drink. I was doing morning drinking by the time I was in the 11th grade. It was the only way that I could face the world. I was doing whatever I could to get what it was that I needed. And so I had a regular job. It was part-time. I was a B&E artist. And I was being stalked by the police because I was a known felon, and that's their job. And I was moving from circle of friends to circle of friends to circle of friends because I would use them up so quickly because I'm a lover of things and a user of people, and I don't care who you are. All I care about is what you can give me. And I needed everything you had, emotionally, spiritually, financially, and physically. I needed it all. And so they got tired of me real quick, and I would move on to the next set. And so I'm living in an apartment with some friends. I'm 17, turning 18. I've moved out of my parents' house because they want me to follow rules. I don't do rules. Don't tell me what to do and not to do. Especially don't tell me what not to do. I absolutely understand. As soon as you tell me what not to do, that's the first thing I'm doing. I have this mindset that it's not so much that I want to do it. It's I want to see if I can get away with it. Did you know ATMs have cameras in them? It was the early days of ATMs. I didn't know that, but they do. And so I'm living in this apartment, and I've ripped off my roommate. I took a driver's license from one and some checks on a closed account from the other, and so the other wrote the first some checks, and I just went down to the bank and cashed them for him. And I didn't know how I had harmed them. Because I didn't actually steal anything. I mean, I gave his license back. It wasn't like I stole anything. Because loyalty and trust and friendship didn't mean anything to me. They weren't values that I valued. I didn't need them. And so my parents by that time had moved to Montgomery, Alabama. I had burned my last bridge in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I was facing some charges. Mellon Bank said, if you leave the state, we won't press charges. So I picked up the phone and I called my mommy. And she gave me a non-refundable, one-way, non-transferable, either use it or lose it bus ticket to Montgomery, Alabama. God bless that woman. And I arrived in Montgomery, and I brought all of me with me. I thought it was Pittsburgh. I thought it was the Pittsburgh police. I could have told you it was Debbie and Clarkie. That's what's wrong. You know, they got me, like, doing all kind of psychedelic Kool-Aid stuff, and that's my problem. And I get down here, and I move into a boarding house because Mom and Daddy don't let me live with them anymore. And I quickly broke all the rules at the boarding house, and so Mommy and Daddy let me live with them again. They had never taken Angie's lesson of if you're going to make a statement and an ultimatum, you'd better be willing to live with it. And so I'm living at their house, and I'm borrowing the car at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, pushing it down the driveway so they won't know I used it, and going out and running the roads. And then that day comes when I'm arrested along with the Dodge Aspen station wagon on the 20-yard line of the high school football field. Apparently, they frown upon that. And about 2 weeks later, my dad gets this letter in the mail from some woman. She's a crazy woman, lived in the mill village in Wetumpka. Apparently, it wasn't just the football field. We'd just gone four-wheeling in Mama's station wagon, and she wanted somebody to pay for that swing set we had taken out in her backyard. It was a long time before I got to find gratitude that I drank at 3 a.m. instead of 3 p.m. when there would have been children on that swing set, because I wouldn't have known. I wouldn't have cared. And don't get me wrong, vehicular manslaughter charges would have sucked. I don't know what happened to me and when it happened and why it happened and whose fault it is. If you can figure that out and tell me, I will pay you cash. But someplace along the line, all I could see was me. It wasn't that I chose to be a complete and total you-know-what. It's just the way I responded to life. It's the way I saw things and saw the world around me was how it, growing up, Christmas was such a big deal in my parents' home. I mean, the same decorations in the same place, even across multiple houses. You could have told, I could have given you $500 that little scented pine Christmas tree looking candle with the sequin decorations on it was going to be sitting right there. And every Christmas morning, we, youngest to oldest, all lined up in our pajamas and our bathrobes to go in and see what Santa had done. And what I remember most about Christmas mornings is my sister got more than me. Mama liked what she bought her better than she liked what I got her. Now, I'll stand here today and tell you that that's not the truth. But you couldn't have convinced me. That's what I saw. That's what I felt. That was the only thing real. His alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Not just that I think I need to drink all this, but that kind of thinking was just the only reality I knew. And I was angry, and I was scared, and I was out to get what I needed and get every bit of it. And if I had to run you down in the process, I'm sorry. I'm not, but I'm sorry. And all of that led me, I got through a three-year career, a six-year enlistment, a three-year career in the Navy before they booted me out. I got through a couple of relationships with joint checking accounts. Those are great before those dried up. You know the relationship is over when the police escort you from the property, and if you don't, you should. I got to experience the sofa surfing. Anybody here love to sofa surf? That goes through friends almost as fast as drinking their beer. I got to experience getting kicked out of my parents' house again and again and again. Cushing, you need to get a job and move out, or just move out. I won't let you destroy this family anymore. You know, I talked about that little 9-year-old girl. Did I mention the fact that from the time she was born, or the girl that's 9 years younger than me, from the time she was born until she was 17, the course of my alcoholic insanity, that woman, that girl didn't have a family because they spent every waking moment wondering what the hell I was going to do next. How do you make amends for that? How do you make that right? I'm sorry I stole your childhood. I mean, there's probably some alcoholic parents in here who have had something very similar that they have had to walk through. And what I can tell you before going into a bunch of it is that you can't. I know, because my sister made this big book cover for me for Christmas when I was six or seven years sober. We had very slowly begun to rebuild the relationship, brother and sister, in our family. And she did this for me because she knew that was the most important thing in the world to me, and she wanted to be a part of that that was giving her a brother back. It is possible to take not just the spiritual illness from my past, but all of the stuff that I did and didn't do. And it is possible to turn that around and create something wonderful with my sisters, with my parents, with past employers, with God. And so I want to talk to you about what happened, because it started to happen. I mean, it's been building up. I'm drinking 24/7. I drink in the mornings because I need wine in the morning to walk out the door, you know, wherever I come to, whether it's in the car, in the bed, in the sofa, in the lobby, or riding up and down on the elevator while those normies go to work. I need to get to my apartment and go into my little refrigerator in my kitchen, and I pull out that Carlo Rossi jug of Rhine wine, ice cold, sweet, sour, with some citric acid to it so it cuts through the brown crap in my mouth from the night before. And I take 12 to 16 ounces of that in, and I start swallowing it down, and about halfway through, the whole world backs up 10 feet, and I can breathe. Am I going to go to work? Am I not going to go to work? Am I going to pay the rent? What lie am I going to tell? Am I going to go by Mama's to get some cash? Am I going to ask Mama for cash, or am I just going to take it? And that morning came around, and I'm in my apartment, and there's no wine in my refrigerator. There's no money in my pockets. My car's broken down in the parking lot because I don't believe in, you know, motor oil. And so I walk 2 miles, mile and a half, 2 miles to my Mama's house. And I knock on the back door, and she lets me in. God bless her. And I need some Cheerios, please. Something to eat. Like I needed dairy in that morning. And while I was there, I took $10 out of my little sister's wallet, because I needed a drink more than I needed her to trust me. And as I walked away from the house that morning, I knew that when they found that money, it was I thought that was the last straw. I was probably right. And I'd love to say that I had this overwhelming sense that I want to go find a spiritual awakening and discover a relationship with a power greater than myself amidst a fellowship of wonderful people, but I didn't. I just was scared. They were all I had left. They were the only ones who would bail me if they would bail me, and they were the only ones who would help me if they would help me. They were the only ones who would feed me if I could be fed. They were all I had. And so I turned around and I went back to the house and I gave the money back and I cried, because I'm real good at that. It's effective. And then I said, I want help. And 2 days later, I was in a hospital for the treatment of addictive disease disorder. I didn't know what that was. I knew I was in a hospital. I knew that I was only allowed to smoke out under the tree and only when they told me I could do it. I didn't like it already. They wanted me to play volleyball with a bunch of crazy people. I didn't like it even more. They wanted me to sit in a chair in the middle of the room and tell all of my secrets. I don't even tell my secrets to me. I didn't like it at all. I met the headmistress, Sue S. I don't know if you ever knew Sue S., but what a delight. And she called me absolutely true to form and identified me exactly for who I was. And between her and the counselors at that treatment center, they introduced me to this book. Now, I had been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous before. When I was in Meridian, Mississippi at Yeoman A School in the Navy, they invited me. The commanding officer gave me a cordial invitation to attend a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the locked ward of the state Mississippi State Mental Hospital, right outside of Meridian. And that was real interesting. I met a guy that I partied with for the rest of my time there. But, you know, y'all were just kind of sad. It was just kind of sad. Poor folks can't drink. My God. And so I had even seen the book because Stan had to do the same thing. He was one of my shipmates, and I was bored and didn't feel like working during work hours because I don't like working. And so I was reading some of the stuff, and I thought, that's funny. That's not so funny. I'll just skip that page. But anyway, I'm in there in this treatment facility, and they're introducing me to this thing called the doctor's opinion. And he talks about this thing that happens to people like me when I take a drink that doesn't happen to normal people. And I never had really put it together. I saw the effects, but I didn't know about it. And they called it the phenomenon of craving. And so I started to investigate. I didn't. They told me all of this stuff. The best I can understand is that when I take a drink, I take another drink. And that's how I drink. And that's the most basic understanding I can get of this thing that happens to me. That doesn't. My sister, she can have a glass of wine. And she doesn't have to. She keeps the top of the wine bottle when she opens it. Why? I don't know. My mother, on Mother's Day, we took her to Sinclair's because they did a big Mother's Day brunch thing. And so we took her down there and she had the Mother's Day brunch and they brought her a complimentary glass of sparkling, well, they called it champagne, but it wasn't. It was a sparkling rosé. That ain't champagne. But, I mean, I'm a drunk, but I'm a connoisseur of a drunk. And so she sipped on it, and we chit-chatted, and she sipped on it, and we chit-chatted, and then they brought the food, and she had a couple of more sips, and she finished a very nice brunch, and then she had another sip, and so there was still about a half a glass of wine, and I'm 16, 17 years without a drink, and I'm looking at it going, are you going to drink that or not? I still don't understand Earth people, but So anyway, like I don't even know where I was. I'm in this treatment center, and they introduced me to this idea of the phenomenon of craving, and they take me back through my drinking career. I call it a career. I don't know why. I was apparently promoted several times, but it just caused more cost, no profit. And I began to understand that that's how I drank. I read some of the stories, and Dr. Bob's Nightmare is one of my favorites, but some of the stories, and that was in the third edition. I think I get it. I can't ever drink again, can I? And I left that treatment center after 28 days knowing I could never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And I was done drinking. I had these books. I had you people. I had the counselors in the aftercare. My parents helped me out and got me even with life financially. They paid everything that I owed except for the copay on that treatment center. The boss that I was working for on a second shift job at the time held my job for me so the insurance would cover and promised me a 25 cent an hour raise if I showed up for a month, didn't call in, didn't lay out, wasn't late. 25 cent an hour was a lot of money. Still is. And all I had to do was not drink. And for 3 weeks, the goose hung high. And then my parents went out of town, and I don't remember thinking about it or planning it or, oh my goodness, let's get on the phone and invite everybody. What I remember is there I was. The lock on the liquor cabinet had been busted off, and I had a glass in my hand, pounding on the counter, wondering how I got started this time. And that began 2 years of the most insane life I've ever lived. As I would come in and go out and come in and go out and come, I would pick up white chips and 30-day chips. And I got a 90-day chip once. I wasn't 90 days sober, but I wanted the damn thing. And I kept thinking, if I can just get enough time without a drink, I'll be okay. That magic year, I love the magic year when you have a year, you can meet the man or woman of your dreams and ride off into the sunset because you've got a year, and you can begin to change your jobs and go to school, and everything's wonderful at a year. And I didn't get anywhere close to a year, but the book sort of says that. See if you can leave it alone for a year. Most of the people interested in this book can't do it for anything close to a year. And that was me. And I bounced from some jobs to relationships and cars to cars and sofa surfing again. And in all of the lifestyle that went with the way I drank. And where I ended up is I'm living in a shotgun duplex in the north end of Montgomery because mommy's paying the rent for me because she doesn't want to watch me die in the street. And I'm working as the happy hour bartender and janitor at a little dive in downtown Montgomery because it's the only work I could get that I went in late enough that I could, you know, like get up for it. And it was a bar with a bar tab. So, you know, that's my, you know, first things first. And I would come in at noon and I would clean the place up and I'd have a few just to get the edge off. And then I'd open up the bar at 5 and I would do the controlled drinking where you drink just enough to keep the screaming heebie-jeebies off of you, but not enough to mess up the bar tab. And then at 9 o'clock, I came out from around that bar and I drank the way I drank. And by 10:15, 10:30, I was passed out in the back room, so drunk I should have slept the clock around. But about 45 minutes, an hour later, I'm back up, madly searching for another drink. And I did whatever I had to get it. And I was a liar, a cheat, a thief, a drunk, and a whore. And I became that thing that I used to laugh at. I became that thing that I thought was disgusting. I became that thing that I would never be. And I couldn't look in a mirror anymore. And I couldn't look into the eyes of strangers. And I certainly couldn't look into the eyes of people that knew me because I knew that they knew. And I began to pray the prayer of the alcoholic. God, please just let me die. I can't do this anymore. Help. My executioner's name was Bill Kay. He was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous who'd watched me bounce in and out of these rooms for a couple of years, doing nothing that you suggested and everything you suggested I not do. And he began to show up at my bar at happy hour, drinking Sprite and being happy. God, I hated him. I wanted to pour vodka in that glass so bad, you know? And he never preached at me. He never put his finger in my face. He never told me what I should do or be or think or feel. He just let me see Alcoholics Anonymous working in his life. But he was sneaky, and you people are sneaky, because one night I found myself in the car with him on my way to an A&A meeting. Now, I had tried A&A. It wasn't going to work. I gave it a good shot, and there I was, and after the bar, I told him a lie. After the meeting, I told him a lie, and he took me back to my bar. I got drunk. The next night, he took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at the Froggy Bottom group, and after the meeting, I told him some lie, and he took me back to my bar, and I got drunk. The next night, he took me to the Young People's group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the laughter and the joyous camaraderie, the absolute insanity that was in that room, And I walked in, and they'd seen me for a while, and they greeted me. They welcomed me, and they got me half a cup of coffee. And then they had a meeting, and it wasn't about me, which, you know, I thought was a failure on their part. But and after the meeting, they do this thing. They say, this is the chip system. And the first chip is the white chip. Back in those days, they came from Walmart. They were just poker chips. And the white chip, the color signifies surrender. This is not a truce. This is absolute, unconditional surrender. When you take a white chip, you give up the old way of life and you start to become a winner. Does anybody want a white chip? One more time. Walk on down there. Bring them all back because she'll melt them down and make you a plaque. And then we all held hands and said the Lord's Prayer. And I don't know how they could hold my hands. They were so sweaty. They were so, I was just jumping out of my ever-loving mind. And then I stood on one side of the room and they all stood on the other side of the room like I had COVID. They didn't. That's what it felt like. I felt so alone and separate and apart from, and it worked for you, but it's never going to work for me. And Dave Kay, this little Irish fella, came bouncing across the room, happy, joyous, and free. Yeah, bam! Sorry, violence, my bad. And he didn't have any show. Has it gotten any better out there? Have you had enough yet? He wrapped his arms around me and he said, welcome home. Welcome home. I'm so grateful for that. I know we all find exactly what it is we need. I believe that, but that's what I needed that night. And so I started going to A&A, and I stopped drinking, and I got out the book and cleaned the pot seeds out of it and started to try to read it and memorize it, because if I could quote it, then I'd be okay. And I started going to meetings and hearing really great stuff out of John, and I would run down and I would share it, and Robert would go, wow, that's really great, and you didn't make that up. And I just set out to impress Alcoholics Anonymous. Y'all are very difficult to impress. But for 5 months, I didn't take a drink. I got a job. I got a little car. I had a place to live. I was going to meetings. I was carrying Julie to meetings. She had cerebral palsy, and her wheelchair luckily fit exactly in the trunk of my Toyota Corolla, the Tercel. Anyway, and I began to play softball and hang out. Anybody here do like Shoney's or whatever the restaurant is called after the meeting? Make sure that you drag the newcomer with you. If you don't already, you probably do. But we're standing there thinking we need some engraved invitation. I thought that I don't belong. And they laughed when I finally got invited. They said, man, we've been waiting for you to join us. Where have you been? And they made me feel as though at least they liked me. At least they cared. I think that that's one of the things that sometimes I get. I'm so zealous about, I want you to read this book, and I want you to understand this, and I forget to remind you that I love you, and I've absolutely walked in your shoes, and I know that you're feeling pain and fear and all of that ick that we walk in here feeling, and that's the first thing I want you to know, is that we can get through all of that. If there is anybody in here who is in their first 30, 60, 90 days of recovery, and maybe it's not the first time, I want you to know something. You don't ever have to take another drink, even if you do want to. That's my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. 5 months without a drink, without any steps, without a sponsor, without a solution, but lots of meetings and some really good strawberry pie from Shoney's. And I'm in Nashville, Tennessee at the International Conference of Young People in Alcoholics Anonymous. I drove Julie up there. You haven't lived till you take a little girl who is in a wheelchair from cerebral palsy from birth, who was the poster child for a while, and you take her on her first roller coaster ride. I thought she was dead. She wasn't, so it's okay. And I don't know what time I started, so I'll get done when I'm done, and y'all stop listening when you stop listening, and we'll figure it all out. And I'm sitting up there, and for a while, the voice had started coming back. I don't know if you ever have that voice, the one that says, you can go get one. It's a special, you need one. It's a rough day. It's a desire to stop drinking. You don't even really have to quit. Nobody will notice. You can go back to the meetings Monday. than the one that I always succumb to. Who do you think you're fooling? You're never going to stay sober, you loser. I didn't want to drink. I wanted to be sober. I wanted what I thought you people had. I didn't know what it was, but I wanted to not be me anymore. I wanted to not hurt my mother anymore. I wanted to quit getting arrested. I wanted something better, and I didn't want to take a drink. And I knew I was going to, and there was nothing I could do about it. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol. It didn't matter what happened after I took the first drink. What mattered was I was going to take it whether I wanted to or not. I've never been so crushed, so angry. How did you do this to me? So afraid. And I sat in a marathon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. No food, no sleep, way too much coffee. We didn't have energy drinks back then. And I said, if this is sobriety, you can have it. This sucks. And you people are not only sneaky, you're fast. Before I could get out of that room, two of you met me at the door. And you lockstepped me to the coffee room, because what I needed was more coffee. And they began to share with me their experience, strength, and hope, one-on-one, eyeball to eyeball, knee to knee. Recovery begins when one alcoholic sits down with another alcoholic, sharing experience, strength, and hope. They 12-stepped me for the first time in my relationship with Alcoholics Anonymous. It had never happened before. I don't know why it had never happened. Perhaps people had tried and I just wasn't listening. That's very likely the case. You know, I'd love to tell you, well, they did it wrong, but the truth of the matter is I was broken, and I had a very challenging time hearing anything. And they began to share with me what they used to be like, and they were just like me. I don't know about you, but I came in with a whole bunch of a huge laundry list of all the reasons that you're not like me. Yeah, we drink alike. I get that, but you never had to do this. 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 You don't know suffering, the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization to the level that I do. But they did. They were just like me, in the same bars, in the same clothes, in the same towns, in the same ways. And they didn't live that way anymore. And not only did they not live that way anymore, they began to share with me what had happened to them. And they didn't talk to me about God. If you remember back at 14, I turned my back. I never turned back around. You know, I absolutely believed in God. And what I believed about God would keep you as far away from God as you could get to. Because that is a ripoff comp deal. I want no part of that. And they talked to me about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, about these actions that they had taken in their lives and the change that had happened in their lives that they didn't even notice while it was going on. They talked to me about repaired relationships. They talked to me about commercial success and relationship success. And they talked to me about being able to walk down the street and not have to hide. They talked to me about what they had. And then they did the most remarkable thing. They held out what they had. And they held out what I had. And they said, which one do you want? No hoops, no understanding, no gymnastics involved. Which one do you want? And I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I haven't always lived well by that decision, but I have never regretted that decision. You people as a whole have never lied to me. You people as a whole have never judged me. You people as a whole have never led me in any direction except the right one. Now, some of the individuals among us, of course, we are flawed. Most of us have feet of clay. I don't know about you, but I'm a liar and a hypocrite at times. It's not a pleasant thing to admit. But as a whole, you people have done nothing but lift me up and propel me toward a life I didn't know I was allowed to have. I thought I had crapped out. I was just waiting to die. And you people showed me that there's a whole new way to live. We got down on our knees and said a prayer that meant nothing to me. Didn't go no higher than the acoustic tile in that room. Bunch of people in the hospitality room looking at us because they were weird. We got up off of our knees and they said, now go home, get a big book, get a sponsor, get to work. And I did the most amazing thing an alcoholic can do. I took their suggestion. I came back to Montgomery. I got my big book out. I went to a meeting, the 12 Steps Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I picked out the person that looked like they were in charge because she thought she was. And I grabbed a hold of her and I didn't let go. And she walked me through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, step by step. She didn't read the book at me. What she did is she made sure that I'd read. She quizzed me, pop quiz, and I made mostly B's and B minuses, but that's okay. I didn't do the homework. And she took me through writing an inventory. I'm so grateful for that because we got to that sex inventory, you know, the one we don't ever talk about because it's way too short. And she said, we're not going to look at sex. We're going to look at conduct. She said, where were you selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate, and who did you hurt? Well, that's all of my relationships, but that's also every neighbor that I ever broke into their home. That's my mother and my mother again and my mother again and again and again. It's everybody that I ever met. I had been selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate, and I had harmed them. And I got to take a look at all the things I had done, and then that wonderful question that Angie brought up, what should I have done instead? And I wasn't allowed, well, I stole money. I'm not allowed, I shouldn't have stolen the money. I was taught about how you should be self-supporting through your own contributions and then give a little to help the family. What a concept. I was walked through a fifth step, and you've heard a little bit, and I stayed way too drunk, way too long, and I apologize, but I was a bit of a thief. And this woman sat me in her living room and she listened to my fifth step and learned all about what a piece of junk I was. And I didn't have a place to go back to. I was living in a little room behind my mother's garage at that point. And there was no place to sit quietly for an hour and pull a book off a shelf. I didn't have a shelf. So she said, you stay here. I'm going to go to the store. And this woman left me alone in her home for an hour to consider the first five proposals. And I didn't steal anything. I didn't even look in her medicine cabinet. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. I got into six and seven, and like it's been shared before, it's kind of a breeze. And, okay, God, I'm ready to be wiped clean now. Apparently it didn't take, kind of like the six baptisms. And I got into eight, nine, and 10, and the most amazing thing happened. I was instructed in step 11 to improve a conscious contact with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous because I didn't have a relationship with God. And this doesn't apply to atheists and agnostics. This is about those of us that truly believe in hate. And so I, at that point in my time, I had been introduced to service, and I got very active in service, general service, group service, intergroup. We were running the Harder Dixie Roundup in Montgomery. I began serving on every single committee. I sat in every single subcommittee. I became very important. I learned those traditions. I carried around the large print where I could beat up entire districts with stuff they were supposed to know, and I became an expert in my own mind. And I don't know about you, but when I'm scared, I begin to run. I'm a runner. And I was scared because I didn't know how to improve that conscious contact, and I didn't know how to stay sober if I could. And so I was running as hard and as fast as I could. But they told me if you stay in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, you won't fall off when you fall down. And so I was running as hard and as fast as I could in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm grateful for that. Number one, I didn't have to drink. Number two, I met a lot of really great people. And number three, it set me up for a course of action in service that has been an incredible gift in my life. But I will tell you, service alone will not keep me sober. It can't. It takes all three sides of that triangle for me. I have hidden out. I have gathered titles. I am the past delegate, Panel 55, Area 1, Alabama, Northwest Florida. Thank you very much. Still only stay sober one day at a time. And still have to take action and work steps. And I hate that word, work steps. Here are the steps we took. We take steps. It's one step after the other on a journey of a lifetime. But going back to this, so I'm running as hard and as fast as I can in this stuff. And somebody says, whoa, stop. If you're having trouble with a step, why don't you back up to the step before? Well, I'd never heard that more than 100,000 times. And And so they back my silly butt all the way up, and I'm resentful at God. You created me and hate me for it. I'm fearful of God. When you live the way I live, you don't feel safe. And I am utterly ashamed in the presence of God. And I wrote it all down. I got it all out, all of the things that I thought God had done and not done, and all of the things that that affected, and where was I selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate. And one of the biggest pieces that I discovered is the dishonesty of that. You see, I found out I was wrong. I found out that God never hated me. Anybody here ever go through life thinking God just expects too much? And I found out that God never wanted anything from me. He wanted everything for me. I found out that I didn't have to be afraid. And I got honest with God and with myself and with another human being. And my fears fell from me, and I could be alone at perfect peace and ease. I began to feel the nearness of my Creator. I walked into 6 and 7 again, and it wasn't about please wipe me clean. It was about help me put down my weapons. Because I cannot pick up tools until I have laid down my weapons. And that's all those character defects are spiritual tools for a self-centered world. They're the weapons I used to blaze my way through everybody that was in my way. And I still have all of them. Sometimes they're nicely on display. Sometimes they're locked away safely. Sometimes I'm carrying them around pretending that they're spiritual tools. And I continue to pray that prayer, and it's probably my favorite prayer, my Creator. What a name, my Creator. I am created every minute of every day. Every heartbeat is another opportunity to be somebody or something new. What's that prayer in step 4? Direct my attention to what you would have me be. Because when I know what I should be, if I'm willing to be that, I always know what to do. I'm now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. Not just my character defects. Here is my love, my hope, my wants, my dreams. It's all yours. Because I trust you with it. And I want what you have to offer me. Now, I will tell you right now, that's what the prayer says to me.
But that's not always the way I live in that prayer.
My finances are a wreck. I have got a string of failed relationships because I like to get into a relationship before I know anybody. And that's just telling you the truth. You know, Angie understands that. I do have some positives. I have been in the same position now, the same job, company, different positions. I kept getting promoted for 18 years. I never did anything for 18 years. I was been allowed to travel the Southeast and even beyond, carrying the message and in service to Alcoholics Anonymous. You people trusted me. I remember how astounded it was, and it was sort of like that fifth step with the sponsor when District 8 in Montgomery handed me the checkbook, made me the ADCM and treasurer, and I was even more amazed when I handed it back and every penny was accounted for. And since my parents were my primary victims, later in his life, my father became developed Alzheimer's. And because my mother had had a stroke and couldn't speak anymore, she didn't have her words anymore, and so Daddy moved in with me. And he lived with me the last 2 years of his life. And my family had a family meeting. You ever been the victim of one of them family meetings? Well, this one was different. It's where they all got together and decided I should be his conservator, and they handed me his checkbook. And when my father passed away, I handed him my father's checkbook. And every penny was accounted for, and I haven't even borrowed any. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. I managed to go to school on a full scholarship and make summa cum laude and honor for my school.
Took 23 years, but who's counting?
And the degree that I took down was in theater. You may notice that I'm a little bit dramatic. I used to try to hide that factor, not really hide it, but just sort of gloss over it. But I mean, it's just a fact that allows me or gives me an instrument or a tool that I can possibly use in order to do some good. And so I make no bones about it anymore. And I'm grateful for that. That's those layers of honesty as I keep coming back, because I'm so afraid, what will you think if I admit this? And then I realize that you don't care. I mean, I believe you care deeply, but you just don't care. And so I began, you know, delving into and exploring this relationship with God, and it is going through these amazing changes. As I draw nearer to God, God reveals God's self to me. And I don't know that it's the same way God reveals to you. I don't care. Well, what I'm discovering is that I am absolutely in the presence of a loving Creator every moment of my life, even when I refuse to acknowledge it. And it's right there. And all I have to do is accept and acknowledge. God never needed my praise. He doesn't need my applause. He doesn't need me to give him some. I need to remember that God is God and I am Cushing. And so it has developed into an absolutely beautiful conversation that I sometimes forget to call for a little while. You got any of those friends that you think about them all the time, but I forgot to talk to them for a while, and then I go back and I say, "Hey, God," and God says, "How you doing? I've been waiting to hear from you. How you been?" And I said, "Well, you know, I've been running a little bit, and it was going great for a while, but I've just hit another wall, and I don't want you to do anything with the wall, but I want you to show me how I got here again. Because I need to know that. And then we'll figure out how to get around or over or through the wall. But before I can do any of that, before I can tackle any obstacle, you know, when I got here, I thought all of this, the money, the job, the car, the boyfriend, the house, the whatever, was what was going, see, I'm sober. I have the life that I'm supposed to have. And I finally understood that it's got nothing to do with that. But what happens to me is that today I think that the respect, the admiration, the number of sponsees, the salary, the car, the house. And I know better. I know better. Maya said, when I knew better, I would do better. And so now it's my responsibility to do better. And the only way I know to do this, we admitted we were powerless. I discovered that the main thing I am powerless over occupies about a cubic foot atop my head. I get these thoughts. I get these ideas. I get these feelings. I get these impressions, these attitudes, these wants, these needs. And they're all in my head. And I'm still, to this day, about 3, 4, 5, 6 hours from 36 years of continuous sobriety. And they still come. And what's worse, I still listen to them. I go, "Oh, that does sound like a good idea. We should do that." But you have given me a fail-safe that allows me to continue to live a life that doesn't include booze, doesn't include robbing people. It doesn't include telling huge lies. And one of these days, I'll be honest enough to tell you that I don't tell any lies at all, but I can't do that yet. You gave me the 12th step. I had come through to this point, and I had worked with a couple of guys, and they got drunk and made me look bad. And but you stayed sober. Yeah. And but the biggest part about all of that was that I got to start taking time out of my life for somebody else. And at first it was very begrudging, and I made sure that you sat in the back seat and you only spoke when spoken to, and it's yes sir and no sir to you. And because, you know, don't you know who I am? And the most amazing thing happened. I started serving these guys, and I began to love them, to genuinely care about someone other than myself. It was a new experience for me. I don't know if it was new for all of you, but it was absolutely, I had never experienced it before. When Philip died, it crushed me. When Paul went back out and decided that he was going to end up where he ended up, it hurt so bad. At times it became so much that I almost didn't want to do it anymore, you know? Or at least not care as much. Maybe I could become one of those very factually based sponsors. But you know, the price of not caring versus the price of being hurt, I'll take hurt every single time. And the lesson wasn't just about the newcomer. I began to serve my community. And I began to love my community. I began to serve my parents. And I started to love my parents and truly care about them. They weren't just a checking account anymore. I began to serve my God. And I began to love my God. And I began to understand that that's all there is. That's all we have to offer, is a way to discover love. I don't know about you, and I can look back at my relationships. I can look back at every relationship, you know, romantic or not. And you love me, prove it. You love me, prove it. You love me, prove it. Because you could tell me all day long and I didn't feel your love. I abused it. And you taught me how to serve. And you taught me how to love and care for my fellow man. And God's love began to fill me to share with them. And I am full. And I am happy. And I am joyous and free, and it's enough. It's finally enough. Thank you for my love, thank you for my life, and thank you for my sobriety. I'll shut up.